Source Services Office, Pentagon. I was in a state of shock. I was still seated at my desk with my hands on my lap, and I really hadn't moved other than from the force that pushed me back a little. Burning debris from the ceiling fell and landed on my hands. I shook my hands, I got up out of my chair, and I started to look around. Everything around me was on fire.
Louise Rogers, accountant, Resource Services Office, Pentagon. Everything went black. The only noise was the crackling of flames, and it was sheer devastation. I remember the grit from the soot in my teeth. I looked around trying to figure out how to get out. Fortunately, being at the fax machine, I was standing in front of a table, a work table that was in front of the window. Then I tried to figure out if I could get my feet out of the debris. I picked up one foot after the other and walked over to the table. The window had been blown out by the impact, and I climbed out.
Sheila Denise Moody. I was trapped in my cubicle space with nowhere to go and no way to get out. There was another coworker who was seated in the cubicle behind me, and she cried out, "What's going on? What's happening? Is anybody there?" I said, "I'm here, I'm here." She said, "Who is it?" I said, "It's me, Sheila." She said, "My skin is on fire. I feel like I'm burning." I told her, "I know it hurts, baby, but we've got to find a way to get out of here."
Louise Rogers. As I was walking out the window, the very first Pentagon police car came around the building. He saw me, stopped, and walked toward me and told me to sit down in the back of the police car. I told him I saw someone else in the office that couldn't get out. She was alive. I didn't realize that not everyone was alive at that point, but she was having trouble. He came back with some help, some others, to get her out. She went into the intensive care ward, but she was one of the ones that didn't make it.
Sheila Denise Moody. I could see a window to the right of me. It was too far up. I was able to reach it with my hand and try to bang on it, but the glass was too thick. When I hit the window, I left a blood print of my hand on the window. I didn't even realize at the time that I was bleeding. I said, "God, I don't believe you brought me here for me to die like this." No sooner had I spoken those words than there was a voice I could hear through the smoke. "Is there anybody in here?" I called back to him. I said, "Yes, we're here." He said, "I can't see you." I said, "I can't see you either, but we're here. Please keep coming." With those last words, the smoke and the fumes started to take my breath away. I couldn't speak anymore, and I started to cough and choke. Coughing and choking, something ran through my mind and said, "Clap your hands." I started to clap my hands together as hard and as loud as I could, hoping that he could follow the sound. I could hear a fire extinguisher.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. There was a woman on her knees clapping her hands. She couldn't breathe. I reached for her, reached through the clouds.
Sheila Denise Moody. Just for a split second through the smoke, I could see the silhouette of a figure. I stepped over some debris, reached out through the smoke, and there was a hand reaching back, and he pulled me out.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. Her hands were stuck up in this position. Her face was covered full of ash. I was told later on that's a natural fetal position for burn victims. The colonel and I ran her to safety.
Sheila Denise Moody. When Sergeant Brahman came to the smoke calling, "Is there anybody in there?" my voice was still the only voice that called back to him.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. Colonel Anderson and I went into the building at least four times. The heat inside was so hot it felt like the sun kissing you.
Sheila Denise Moody. My rescuer is Sergeant Christopher Brahman. In talking to him in the months since then, I found out that he actually came into the area that I was in on his third time into the building, trying to get in to see who he could help and save. Of all the people that he was able to pull out and able to help, I'm the only one who survived.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. We were getting ready to make entry again, and the firemen stopped us. Other firemen showed up, and they physically restrained us and pulled us away from the building. I was completely and totally out of my mind at that point, reverting to full combat mode. So did Chris. He had been in the Ranger Regiment. He fought in Mogadishu. As far as I was concerned, this was a combat situation.
Staff Sergeant Christopher Brahman. We were so jacked up on adrenaline. Colonel Anderson kept getting into fights with different authority figures, firemen, military, it didn't matter who it was. There was no question that this was another battle zone.
Sheila Denise Moody. It was chaos. People were running in every direction, and they were crying, they were screaming. I went to the line where they had people who were wounded. As I was walking in that direction, I heard someone call my name, Sheila! I looked up, and it was Louise. She was sitting in the back of a police car.
Louise Rogers. There were more and more people coming out, and we kept moving farther and farther back out of the way until we were sitting back up against the guardrail at the highway.
Sheila Denise Moody. I think they ended up putting like 3 or 4 of us in the back of the ambulance and taking us to Arlington Hospital.
Louise Rogers. By that time, I wasn't feeling too good. As soon as I got into the ambulance, my hands started to hurt. There was a burning pain. I said to the medic, "Well, this is starting to hurt." Then I passed out. I don't remember much of anything for days after that.
Lieutenant Colonel Ted Anderson. A 3-star general showed up along with a couple other generals, and I explained to them what was going on. This 3-star general basically felt the same way I did, and he went to the on-site fire commander and said, "Look, I will take full responsibility. We need to make an attempt to go in and get our people out." He was overruled by the fire captain. I have since come to know that the fire captain was correct to do so. I am now certain that they saved my life, and I'm certain they saved Chris's life as well. My whole outlook on the American firefighter changed that day. Those guys were the real heroes of the day for me. I've talked to firemen who later went into that area, and there was no way out. That last burn guy we brought out was the last person to come out of the building alive on the exterior side of the Pentagon.
Sheila Denise Moody. We lost 34 co-workers that day between the accounting division, which was the office that I was in, and the budget office, which was right across the hall. That area sustained pretty much a direct hit from the airplane.
Dennis Smith. I had turnout gear, fire department self-contained breathing apparatus. I had air for an hour. I was sweeping every room to see if anyone was still alive. As I made my way through the smoke and flames, there was water all over the floor, 9 or 10 inches on the floor because the pipes had broken. Stairwells were like waterfalls. There were body parts floating around. I saw a foot, a torso, a lady hanging upside down from a chair, someone's head sitting on a file cabinet, totally burned. I found people sitting at a conference table, totally charred. I found a man standing with his arms up in defense, leaning against the wall. Apparently, he saw it coming. He was totally burned. I went floor to floor on the collapsed 4th corridor side and yelled to see if anybody was still alive. I didn't find anyone.
Captain Robert Gray, Technical Rescue, Station 4, Arlington County Fire Department. Jet fuel was in everything. It was laying on the film on the surface of the water that we were walking through, so it made the gear smell.
Lieutenant Commander David Tarantino, physician, United States Navy. The flames and the smoke were too intense by that time, and even the rescue crews couldn't really penetrate into the buildings. Not too many people were brought out after that.
Captain Robert Gray. It was really remarkable because you'd be on the 2nd or 3rd floor and you'd find a room that was absolutely pristine. It's surrounded by complete destruction. The ductwork down on the floors, the file cabinets completely ripped apart. And then one room just like this, where there's not even but a light layer of smoke on the wall. The flags, magazines sitting on the desk. It was how the gas mixed with the air and vented through the buildings under pressure, and then blew certain areas up and preserved others.
Captain Charles Gibbs. The military had their corps people with stretchers and all that, but there were no people.
In the minutes after the Pentagon attack, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld found himself torn between his official role, which called for him to lead the nation's response, and his human desire to examine the crash scene and help the injured men and women under his command.
Aubrey Davis, Officer, Protective Service Unit, Defense Protective Service, Pentagon. The Secretary was walking fast, and we were walking fast with him. As we proceeded down that hallway, a colonel ran up with a cut on his forehead and said, "Sir, it's dangerous. Don't go down there."
Gilbert Aldock, Officer, Protective Service Unit, Defensive Protective Service, Pentagon. We were in smoke and finally saw that light. The doors were open and the sun was coming in. You could see the light.
Donald Rumsfeld. I saw the field out there sprayed with pieces of metal.
Aubrey Davis. I remember the secretary reaching down and picking up a piece of the plane with the name of the aircraft or something on it. He said, "This is American Airlines."
Donald Rumsfeld. Oh, my Lord, the whole place was burning. People were being pulled out and stretchers were being carried to ambulances.
Aubrey Davis. The communications center kept asking where the secretary was, and I kept saying we had him. They couldn't hear.
Victoria Tory Clark, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs. Several times in the next half hour or so, people would ask where the secretary was. The answer was, out of the building. We took that to mean that he had been taken to a secure location. But he had gone out to the site.
Mary Matlin. There was a real concern in getting information about the casualties at the Defense Department. At first, we thought Secretary Rumsfeld had been hit. Then we heard he was pulling bodies out of the rubble. We couldn't quite get a location on the Secretary of Defense.
Joe Wassel. There were people to our left sitting on the grass. They were starting to set some triage when we heard someone say, "Hey, I need some help."
Aubrey Davis. I recalled that Secretary Rumsfeld had been in the Navy. He was like the captain going down with the ship. He was going to make sure everything was okay before he went back.
Donald Rumsfeld. I tried to get some folks to help out and helped out a bit myself. I talked to some people about what had taken place.
Aubrey Davis. At one point, someone ran up to the secretary asking for help. The secretary asked him what he needed, and Rumsfeld motioned to his communications guy, Joe Wassel. He said, "Tell them what you need." He said, "We need helicopters and such." We were still trying to get the secretary off the site of impact. We heard that the Park Police helicopter, Eagle One, was going to land to take him out of there. He said, "No. If they land, they will use it to transport the injured."
Donald Rumsfeld. I decided I had done what I could. There were enough people there, and went inside.
Victoria Tory Clark. The next thing we knew, he had come into the command center, dirty, sweaty, with his jacket over his shoulder.
Colonel Matthew Klimo. About 10:30, Secretary Rumsfeld joined us. He immediately asked for an update, especially on the rules of engagement. We explained the policy we had agreed with General Ralph Eberhardt. We were going to try to persuade a potentially hijacked plane to land, but if it was headed to a large city, take it down. Everybody was calm and cool. Rumsfeld then confirmed with Vice President Cheney what the ROE was. It was around 10:30 that we received a report that there was an unknown aircraft about 5 miles out. It was a blip on the radar screen that had disappeared. We thought this was it. The plane was minutes, maybe even seconds away from hitting us.
This may have been more garbled communication about Flight 93, which government officials in Washington still didn't know had crashed in Pennsylvania. The spooky music was playing. In between collapses. The 29 minutes between the collapse of the South Tower and the collapse of the North Tower were filled with tension for those inside the remaining building, as well as for loved ones waiting for word on whether their family members could or would escape. Due to faulty communications, not all of the firefighters inside the North Tower received the order to evacuate. So even in the final minutes of the North Tower's life, some FDNY firefighters trudged upward toward the crash zone. Others, though, heard the warnings and simply refused to leave.
Thomas von Essen, Commissioner, FDNY. To understand all this,
it is important to understand what it means to be a firefighter. Firefighters do not run away. They do not leave if they think they can stay.
Captain J. Jonas, the period of time between the two collapses was the scariest. The unknown was about to come up and get you. It was like watching the old Frankenstein movies when you were a kid and you had the spooky music playing in the background. Well, the spooky music was playing because that monster was about to come up and get you. That was the most anxiety I had the whole day.
Joe Graziano, firefighter, ladder 13 FDMY, North Tower Stairs. They told us to evacuate Tower 1. We ran into a fireman, Billy Casey, from Engine 21. He was carrying a gentleman who was having heart problems, a big guy, and Billy was having trouble. I turned to my captain, Walter Hines, and said, "Cap, I'm going to help this guy down."
Captain J. Jonas. Over the radio, I did hear Chief Pete Hayden calling for an evacuation for guys to get out. In particular, he engaged Patty Brown. He called him by name. "Captain Patty Brown, command post to Ladder 3. Captain Patty Brown, evacuate the building." Patty got on the radio and he said, "I refuse the order. I'm on the 44th floor. I got too many burned people here. I'm not leaving them." Even in that high anxiety situation, I thought, wow, that's unbelievable. That was an incredible act of bravery.
David Norman. We started to move quickly down the stairs. We would inform everybody on the way down of the fire department units that were on these floors. "Listen, we've been told to evacuate. We're leaving." We ran into some Port Authority personnel who were in disbelief. They seemed to think that if they're 20, 30 stories below the affected fire floor, they're safe. They said, "I don't know why you guys are leaving. It's not that bad."
Joe Graziano. Billy and I coaxed the gentleman down. We said, "Look, we're not going to leave you. We'll get you out." We didn't think there was any urgency at all. The man's name was Ralph. That's all I remember about him. Ralph was a trooper. I remember passing other firemen in the stairwell. I passed all the guys from Two Truck and Captain Freddie Ill, who I knew. The strap on my mask was falling down, and I said, "Freddie, do me a favor and fix my strap." He tugged it, and I kept on walking.
Bill Spade. A police officer, John DeLara, came over to me, and we start talking. I certainly was never aware that the fire department was evacuating the buildings. People were filing by, walking through the block strewn with debris. Then there was only a trickle of people coming by. Officer DeLara said, "Maybe we should go back to the doorway and see how many are in that stairway." I said, "Yeah, I guess we should." We went back to the staircase, and his boss was there, Sergeant Sean Curtin. As soon as we got to the staircase, he said, "I think we should leave now." It was only the eight of us in the staircase at this time. I said, "We go together, we stay together."
David Norman. When we got down to the bottom, I realized the magnitude of everything. I thought, there's no building. There was literally no building left. I said to the rest of the team, and I think they saw the urgency in my face, I said, "Listen, we gotta go, and we gotta go now. There's nothing left of that building." When you're told that, and when you see it, are two different things.
Captain J. Jonas. We were heading down the stairs, and right around the 20th floor, we ran into Josephine Harris. She was standing in the doorway. She was crying. She was 1 or 2 weeks shy of her 60th birthday. She had made it down from the 73rd floor. She was a bookkeeper for the Port Authority, with the help of somebody from her office. She told them to go ahead. She probably physically couldn't make another step.
Billy Butler, firefighter, ladder 6, FDNY. When we came upon Josephine, somebody said to me, "Help with this woman."
Captain J. Jonas. Tommy Falco looked at me and said, "Hey, Cap, what do you want to do with her?" I looked at her, and it seemed like an easy decision to make. Of course, we're going to help her. Every fiber in my being was screaming at me to get out of this building. That spooky music was playing. Looking back on it now, yeah, it was an easy decision to make, but it really wasn't because not only was I endangering myself, I was responsible for 5 firemen and their families. It's not an easy decision to make. I looked at her and I couldn't say no. I said, all right, bring her with us. And we did.
Billy Butler. I started down with Josephine.
Captain J. Jonas. Now we're going very slow. What was once a normal gait going down the stairs, now it's only one step at a time. We were creating a logjam of people behind us. On a couple of occasions, we had to step aside to allow that logjam to clear, and then we would continue.
Billy Butler. Everybody was trying to push us along, and it was a very slow process.
Following the two attacks and the first building's collapse, worried family members across the region began to hunt for their loved ones, some heading straight to the World Trade Center, even as the survivors fanned out into a city still unsure of what had transpired.
Dan Potter. My focus was to try to get to my wife, but as I was trying, there were a lot of firefighter duties I had to do also. When somebody said, check that escalator, I went and checked the escalator real quick. But there was always that ring in the back of my head. I have to find out what she's doing. Still, there were victims in the Deutsche Bank that I helped out. You had to do your job as a firefighter. You are dressed to represent New York City as a firefighter. Yes, I've got to take care of my wife, but I still have to be a firefighter.
John Napolitano, father of FDNY firefighter John Napolitano. When the South Tower came down, I tried to get into the city from our house in the outer boroughs, but I couldn't. I said, my son's very good at what he does. He's probably somewhere safe or has people somewhere. I didn't want to think the worst, obviously. I went to my daughter-in-law's house.
Dan Potter. I crossed Greenwich Street and went right into the Deutsche building. I walked into that building and there was a woman shuddering. I said, okay, go to the back of the building, you'll be okay. Five or six people came around the building, all bloody, all different faces, hands, and all covered in gray. They're walking like zombies. I said, just go to the back.
Janine Ali. We walked up to the seaport. There was a Pizzeria Uno. This is actually a very funny story, on the second floor of the seaport. There were chairs and stuff outside. We put our stuff down on the chairs, and we went to go inside this Pizzeria Uno. It was locked. The bartender was leaning against the bar watching the television with his back to us, cleaning a glass. We were pounding on the door, like, let us in, let us in. He turned around and said, we don't open till 11:30. I said, look at the TV. Let us in. He kept saying, we're not open yet. We don't open until 11:30.
Dan Potter. I saw a children's nursery, so I ran in there real quick to see if there were any kids in there. There was too much debris. I had to go back to Greenwich Street. I thought, I'll go around, try to get to the command post, get to the North Tower, save my wife.
John Napolitano. My daughter-in-law was at work when it happened. She worked for Computer Associates, and a lot of colleagues knew that her husband was a firefighter. They said, you better take your kids and go home. When I got to the house, a lot of their friends were already there, and Anne was sitting there, and their two little girls were playing. Elizabeth was going on 6, and Emma was going on 3.
Dan Potter. I came out of the Deutsche building, and I ran into an old friend of mine who I hadn't seen in probably 17 years, a fire marshal, Mel Hazel. He didn't recognize me because I was covered in everything. What he did recognize was the 31 on my helmet, because he had worked there as a fireman. He said, hey, 31, you all right? I realized who he was, and I said, Mel Hazel, Mel, it's me, it's Dan. He said, oh my God, I couldn't recognize you. Need a hand? I've got to find Jean. Jean's on the roof of the first tower. I'm convinced she's up there. Can you help me with that?
Captain J. Jonas. On the way down, I ran into Lieutenant Mike Warcola from Ladder 5, and this was to be his last day in the fire department. He was going to retire on September 12th. I knew Mike. We were firemen together. He and two of his firemen were working on a man in the stairway having chest pains. I looked at him. I said, Mike, let's go. It's time to go. He said, that's okay, Jay. You have your civilian. We have ours. We'll be behind you. We kept going and made it to the fourth floor, and Josephine Harris fell to the floor. She was yelling at us to leave her alone. We weren't going to leave her.
Billy Butler. The whole building started to rock.
Captain J. Jonas. The floor started having little wave-like ripples in it.
Billy Butler. Then everything went black.
It was like a mushroom cloud. The second collapse. At 10:29 a.m., 102 minutes after it had been hit by American Airlines Flight 11, the North Tower collapsed. Its level-by-level pancaking almost exactly the same as the South Tower's. Hundreds were caught inside the building, including many people trapped in or above the impact zone. Thousands more who had just evacuated or were watching the events unfold were caught in the vicinity around the World Trade Center.
Richard Eichen, consultant, PASS Consulting Group, North Tower, 90th floor. There was a ring of EMTs by the door. They started to come for me, and I said, no, take her, because Lucy was now on my back again. I handed her off to an EMT. We were four steps on the sidewalk when someone behind me said, watch out! I remember turning like, what the heck do you want now? I saw he was looking up. I looked up. That was the building starting to collapse.
Joe Graziano. Billy and I finally got Ralph to the lobby. As we got outside, Tower One came down. I could see the building come right at me. I still had no idea that the South Tower had already come down.
Bill Spade. There was an overhang, I believe, at 6 World Trade Center, so we were trying to get through that courtyard area. Things were still coming down from above. NYPD officer John DeLara said, I'll go first. We all followed him.
David Norman. We went almost like you'd see in the war movies in groups of two. Someone would run and get to a point safely, then that person would look and cover for you while you moved.
Bill Spade. We weren't out of the Trade Center 30 seconds, and I heard that noise again.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I was probably on the 22nd floor when, all of a sudden, the building started to shake violently. There was a huge sound from above, this loud, loud noise. I must have dove down about 5 or 6 stairs and pushed myself right into the corner. I basically curled up in a fetal position, and I covered my head with my hands.
Janelle Guzman. The dust, the building, the walls just opened up.
Lieutenant Greg Hansen. It was a complete whiteout in the courtyard. It reminded me of being in a blizzard. All of a sudden, there was this thunderous roar. My first thought was that it was another plane coming in. That's how loud it was. It felt like it was right on top of us. Then it went completely dark. To this day, I don't know how it's possible we survived. The police officers behind us were killed in that collapse. I know Bill Spade and 2 of the police officers had taken the rear.
Stephen Blahar. I heard this sick cracking noise. I looked up and Tower One was curling over my head. Like a wave.
Dan Nigro. The same sound, the same dust cloud. My brain and my body couldn't deal with it this time. I knew we lost hundreds of firefighters.
Juana Lomi. We ran to the corner. By the time we got to the subway steps, there were so many people trying to walk in there that we ended up being pushed all the way down. Everybody fell. It was like a ball of people falling on the steps.
James Luongo, Inspector, NYPD. I was running and running and running. I came up to a fireman who was also running, a tall, skinny guy. I looked over and I saw that it said Chaplain on the helmet. It was Fire Department Chaplain John Delendick from St. Michael's Church in Brooklyn. I was running with him and I said to him, are you a priest? He said, yeah. I said, are you a Catholic priest? He said, yeah. How about absolution? Monsignor John Delendick, Chaplain, FDNY. This police officer came up next to me, running with me, and said, Father, can you hear my confession? I told him, this is an act of war, so I'm going to give everyone general absolution, which I did. General absolution in the Catholic Church is forgiving all at one time. James Luongo.
As you're running, you're looking over your shoulder. You could feel some of the shrapnel flying by. I saw a cop in front of me fall. I figured he got hit with a piece of shrapnel. I reached down and picked him up by his gun belt because he was going to get trampled. I said to him, "You all right? Where did you get hit?" He said, "No, I dropped my pen." It goes to show you how people's minds go. Here he is, running for his life, and he bent down to pick up a pen that he dropped.
Bill Spade. I remember getting picked up and blown into the wall. I hit my face so hard, I thought I lost my eye. I said, "I'm not dying here." I found a window and rolled into it. Inside was an office. I put my head under the desk. Everything was coming down. I said goodbye to my wife and kids.
David Norman. I found a fire truck and I jumped underneath the rear axle. I was the only one initially underneath the fire truck. And then every inch of that fire truck was occupied by somebody doing the same thing. Debris started hitting the fire truck. I thought to myself, "Man, I'm going to get crushed by this fire truck." I ducked under here for cover and now I'm going to get crushed by it.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I heard people screaming. It was loud, like boulders, safes, whatever, a freight train type of noise. In that next split second, I felt the wall that I was laying next to give way and crack open.
Louise Bazzelli. The phone rang, and it was one of Pasquale's aunts. As I was on the phone with her, I started to see his building change. Something was changing about it. The smoke started to get blacker and bellow out more. I started to see the antenna move, and then I knew, that's it. His building is now going.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I found myself free-falling. I felt this wind, abrasive wind. I stayed tucked into a fetal position. I saw flashes of light from impacts hitting my head, 5 or 6. I was seeing those stars you see when you get hit in the head.
Louise Bazzelli. I spoke with him maybe 25 minutes before that, so I knew that there was no way that he made it down from the 64th floor with a whole crowd of people. I kept screaming, "No, no, 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 no!" Every ounce of energy in my body drained out of me. I collapsed on the floor, screaming uncontrollably, watching it come down and thinking, "Our baby will never get to know her father. She'll never get to meet him." I couldn't watch anymore. I went outside. I don't know what was worse, being outside in the beautiful sunshine on a gorgeous day where there were September flowers and peacefulness and birds chirping, or being inside with the horror, watching that. I couldn't fathom how I was in my garden, and my husband, I watched him die, along with thousands of other people.
Lieutenant Colonel Tim Duffy, F-15 pilot, Otis Air Force Base, Cape Cod, Massachusetts. We went over by Kennedy and turned a plane away that was over there. I was going to check out the North Tower and see how it was doing. I flew by. I was looking straight at it. I realized it was exploding right before my eyes. It was the sickest feeling I've ever had.
Frank Lombardi. I saw the antenna of Tower 1 slowly starting to fall, as if a missile was going back into its silo.
Dan Potter. A police officer came running down the street and said, "North Tower's coming down now, any second." Just as he passed, we heard the same crumbling.
Jean Potter. I was in Chinatown when I heard the North Tower collapse.
Dan Potter. It sounded like a freight train, like rumbling thunder. We laid in front of Deutsche Bank because we figured you couldn't outrun this field of stuff coming down. If it clocks you, you're out. You're done.
Andrew Kurtzman. There was this massive, massive boom and a huge plume of smoke. As the building fell like a pancake, that smoke and soot and fire, it went north. It started to chase us, and we went running for our lives.
Lieutenant Terry Tobin, NYPD. People are screaming. The second one's coming down. Get out of here. The best thing was to run toward the water, so I started to run. I took a hard hit to my back, and it knocked me from my feet right down to my knees. I turn around and saw the black cloud coming, approaching very quickly.
Rudy Giuliani. I feel somebody grab me and start running me like you'd run an animal or a horse, like, let's go! And we must have run about a third of a block. I didn't even know what was going on.
Andrew Kurtzman. Giuliani's bodyguard threw his arm around Giuliani and started running. We all bolted and we were being followed by this mushroom cloud.
Rudy Giuliani. He's running me and I said, stop! We turned around and I could see this tremendous cloud coming up through the canyon. It really looked like a nuclear attack.
Tracy Donahue. All of a sudden, this black smoke came flying around the corner like a monster you would see in a movie. It whipped around and came up Broadway.
Richard Eichen. I was running up Fulton Street, and the guy in front of me was walking, and I pushed him to the side. Another guy ran in front of me, and I swept him away. He stumbled, and I hope I didn't seal his fate doing that. I jumped over the hood of a car, which is hilarious if you know me, and continued. Joe Esposito, Chief of Department NYPD. We were pushing people into any open doorway, any building they could get into. You watched it roll toward you like a tidal wave. Richard Eichen. The whole morning seemed like one calamity. Biblical-level calamity after another. An hour before, I was eating a bagel, reading the newspaper, and worrying about my country club food. And now I'm in the middle of some biblical devastation.
Charles Kristoff, attorney, Broadway. We're totally covered with dust. It's unbelievable, like you're in a movie, in science fiction. It's not reality. You don't know what's going on. I didn't have anything with me except my cell phone. I was trying to reach my wife, Kirsten, all the time.
Ian Oldiger. We got to South Street Seaport pretty quickly. We went to a bar, which was full. We got some juice and water. As we were watching it on CNN, we could actually see the towers through this glass window. The TV was right in front of us, and we could see the towers to our left. We could see the second one starting to fall. You saw the whole bar turn their heads to look through the window. As the second tower fell past the point where you couldn't see it anymore, everyone turned back to the TV and watched it fall all the way.
Monica O'Leary, former employee, Cantor Fitzgerald, North Tower. I was in my neighbor's apartment when our building fell. I remember falling to the ground and screaming. They didn't have enough time. They didn't have enough time to get out. I laid on the ground screaming. I knew they were gone.
Robert De Niro, actor, New York City. I lived about 9 blocks north of the World Trade Center. I had my big screen television to my left, and I had the big picture window in front of me. When I saw the North Tower start to go down, I had to look at my television to confirm what I was seeing with my own eyes. It was unreal.
Roger Perino, Lieutenant Commander of Detectives, NYPD. I have no memory of any noise. I didn't hear anything landing near me. I could see shit landing near me, but I couldn't believe I wasn't being hit. I saw stuff hit. I saw a car flip. All of a sudden, I felt like I was covered in blankets. That's the only way to describe it. It was really super soft and basically very comfortable. I felt like it was 20 blankets. Then, in one split second, I began to suffocate.
David Norman. That's when also the wave of concrete dust, it was so thick, overwhelmed us. I couldn't breathe. It's almost as if you took the blown-in insulation, that powdery insulation, and you started trying to breathe through it, and you couldn't.
Dan Potter. I remember swallowing the smoke, and it was like those gray woolen socks. I felt like I could almost eat it.
Stanley Trojanowski, firefighter, engine 238, FDNY. You're choking, trying to breathe. Your eyes are full of debris. You can't see anything.
Richard Eichen. I realize my mouth is packed with this debris, the dust. I dug my mouth out with 2 fingers, putting them in and digging my mouth out. Then I realized I still couldn't breathe, so I stuck my fingers down my throat, and I was able to open a breathing passage.
Dan Potter, we don't know where we are. I scratched the street, and I could see the blacktop, and I said, we're on the street, we're on the street.
Gary Smiley, paramedic, FDNY. Every time I'd breathe in, it was as if my head was stuck in sand.
Bill Spade. I had to reach in my mouth to take clumps of stuff out. When I breathed, it hurt. It seemed like I was inhaling glass. I looked around. There were only four of us left, me and three other firemen. We lost the police officer and all those in that alleyway.
Sharon Miller, officer, PAPD. I got separated from my partner somehow. I stopped and looked to see where everybody else was. The captain, the chief, everybody. I couldn't find anybody. I don't know how far I ran. I ran until I saw Inspector Lawrence Fields and a police officer. They were standing around the corner. I ran over to them and told them who I couldn't find. They were looking at me like I was crazy. They said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I went in the building with Chief James Romito, Captain Kathy Mazza, Lieutenant Robert Seary, Richie Rodriguez, Jimmy Nelson, Jimmy Parham, Steve Hushko." I said, "I got separated from them." I never saw them again. They never found them. They were all killed.
I thought I was dead until I started to cough. Trapped in the ruins. By the time the second tower collapsed, more than 2,600 people would be dead in the rubble around the World Trade Center, including 343 New York City firefighters, 37 members of the PAPD, 23 members of the NYPD, and a dozen other government agents and first responders, as well as former FBI agent John O'Neill. A lucky few would survive the collapse, either inside the Marriott Hotel or buried amid the wreckage of the North and South Towers.
Jeff Johnson, when we got into the banquet room, we were trying to find our way around and get our bearings. That's when the second collapse happened.
Frank Lozano. Jeff obviously knew what it was because he said, "Hit the ground." We got buried under more rubble.
Jeff Johnson. Same thing. Complete black, couldn't breathe. Stifling. You couldn't breathe. You couldn't open your eyes.
Frank Rosano, I remember saying to myself, this can't be happening to me twice in one day. This is impossible. I'm thinking to myself, you can't be lucky enough to survive it twice. I started to pray.
Jeff Johnson, I was so mad. I said, don't let me go. I was praying. I didn't think I was going to make it.
Frank Rosano, every breath you took, you breathed in soot and ash. It was like drowning.
Jeff Johnson. I yelled, "Is everybody okay?" I heard, "I'm okay, I'm okay, I'm okay." But I didn't hear the fourth, "I'm okay." I go, "Who's okay?" They yelled out their names, but none of them was Pat. I started screaming for Pat Carey now.
Frank Rosano. Jeff started to look for a way out. He was frantically looking around to figure out how we were going to get out of here and found a very small opening in a wall on the West Street side of the building. He said, "This is a way out. We are going to climb down."
Jeff Johnson. We took the drapes and we put it out of the hole so that we could back out. I went last. The civilians went first. They put their butts and their legs out first and crawled out. The first guy went out, then the next guy went, and then Frank went, and then I backed out.
Frank Rosano. I saw the banquet manager of the hotel. He went down the drapes and he made it. I figured if he could do it, I could do it.
Jeff Johnson. They just left. I didn't know who Frank was until a year later. I still don't know the names of the other two. Those three guys disappeared, basically walked into the rubble.
Frank Rosano, I can't call it a street because it wasn't a street. There was nothing recognizable as a street. It was a debris field. The first thing I remember seeing as I looked up was that grill work from the World Trade Center stuck in the debris.
William Jimeno. Again, we had no idea that Building 2 had come down at that point. We heard another explosion. Boom! Same as the first one. I remember Dominic Pizzullo backing up a little bit, and I said to him, "This is it. It's over." It sounded like a humongous locomotive coming at us. All I could think was, I'm gonna die. One of the things I've always done with my girls, Allison and Bianca, was I would make the sign language sign for I love you. I made the I love you sign, and I crossed them over my chest. I figured if I was going to die and they found me, they would at least tell my wife that I was crossed like that so she would know I was thinking of her. I could hear Sergeant McLaughlin yelling. Dominic gets sat down like a rag doll with a piece of concrete that came through this little void. I was getting hit more. I was yelling. Just like the first collapse, it seemed to take forever, but it happened quick.
The collapse also caught the firefighters coming down stairwell B with their injured civilian, Josephine Harris, and a PAPD officer evacuating with them, David Lim.
Captain J. Jonas. All the air that was in the building was being compressed, creating tornado-like winds in the stairway. We kept getting battered by debris. It was like 30 people were punching you at the same time. It's industrial strength dust. We covered up and waited for what we thought was going to be our demise. But for us, it didn't come.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. It was a tremendous roar. Then the wind, very, very fierce wind. It started lifting me up off the ground.
Captain J. Jonas. That scary feeling, that anxiety that I had between the two collapses, once the collapse started, it went away. I felt very much at peace. Whatever was going to happen it's on its way.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I crouched down and got to the corner of the staircase by the railing, and I got as small as I could possibly get. I guess the best way to describe it is that I tried to crawl into my fire helmet.
Captain J. Jonas. Then, just before it got to us, it stopped.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. Debris was hitting me and it went dark. The next thing was total silence. Nothing. No wind, no noise, no light. Nothing.
Joe Esposito, Chief of Department, NYPD. I said to my sergeant, we just lost a lot of people. I remember saying, if we lost under 100, it'll be a miracle. It was a miracle. We lost 23, which is still an outrageous number. But that's a miracle.
William Jimeno. When everything was settled, I looked over to my right and I could see Dominic. The concrete had crushed him. He said, Willie, I'm dying. Sergeant McLaughlin was yelling in a lot of pain. I was also in a lot of pain, but I was fighting, trying to talk to Dominic. I said, hold on, Dominic, hold on. Those last couple of minutes, Dominic said to Sergeant McLaughlin, can I have a 3-8? Which is a break for a Port Authority police officer. In the midst of pain, he was finding humor. Sergeant McLaughlin, even though he was yelling, said, yeah, you can take 3-8. Dominic said, Willie, don't forget I died trying to save you guys. His last minutes, he struggled to take his firearm out of his holster. He pointed it up toward that hole in the rubble far over our heads. We had been yelling, PAPD, officers down, hoping someone would hear us. He pointed his firearm up in the air to that hole and fired his gun as a last-ditch effort for someone to hear us. Then he slumped over and died. I was really, really lost mentally. We had not only lost our first two officers, Christopher Amoroso and Antonio Rodriguez, but now I watched Dominic pass. It was very, very tough. I said, Sarge, Dominic's gone. Sarge said, hold on, hold on, I know. This went on for a while, trying to talk to each other back and forth. I said, Sarge, what do we do? What training do we have? He said, Will, this is beyond any training anybody has ever had.
Sergeant John McLaughlin. Nobody trained for this.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I was encapsulated in the debris. I couldn't move much, and I realized I didn't feel like I was injured. I got my wits about me. I said, okay, let me see what I have, what equipment I have. I was feeling around. I still had a light. All the other equipment I was carrying was gone.
Billy Butler. Immediately, you look at yourself to make sure all the fingers are there, the toes are there, and you wiggle them to make sure that nothing's broken. I was beat up, but I was okay. I was trying to extricate myself and pick these large pieces of drywall off myself when Josephine suddenly comes up out of the dust, like the blob coming out of the swamp. She scared the shit out of me.
Lieutenant Mickey Cross. I couldn't see clearly and I thought I was blinded. I'm thinking, oh Jesus, I'm trapped in the World Trade Center and now I'm blind? Is this going to get any worse? I was feeling my eyes and I felt this crust. It was like a quarter inch of dirt encrusted like concrete. I tried peeling it off and it wasn't going. I was able to take my glove off and I stuck my pinky in my mouth. I was trying to wet my finger and peel this crust off my eyes. Eventually, I got most of it off, and I opened my eyes and I was able to at least see this little tiny area I was in. I wasn't blind. I had my eyesight.
Captain J. Jonas. My first thoughts were, who do I still have? Who's still alive? I gave out a roll call and all my people answered. I didn't know Josephine's name yet. I called her the woman and said, do we still have the woman with us? They said, yeah, she's still here.
Josephine Harris, bookkeeper, Port Authority, North Tower, 73rd floor. Somebody was watching over us that day. We had no broken bones. We have no scars.
Captain J. Jonas. In my mind, okay, things are looking good. All right, let's dust ourselves off and get out of here. It didn't quite happen that fast.
Janelle Guzman. When it finally stopped, there was total dead silence. I thought I was dreaming. I shut my eyes, hoping that when I opened them, it would be all a bad dream. I realized it was not. I couldn't move. I tried to get up. I was pinned. I was laying sideways, feet crisscrossed. I couldn't move. I couldn't see anything. The dust, everything was in my mouth. It was complete dark. I realized that this was actually happening.
Pasquale Bazzelli. I had some bumps in my head when I woke up. I was numb. I looked up, and I could see clear sky. A blue sky. For that one instant, I thought I was dead because I felt no pain. I thought I was dead until I started to cough. Then I started to feel pain in my leg, and that's when I realized, oh my God, I can't believe I actually survived this. I'm alive.
Such calm and peace. After the collapse. The collapse of both towers carpeted Lower Manhattan with debris and dust. As survivors emerged from the clouds, they found a city tragically transformed and a once familiar urban landscape rendered almost unrecognizable. Scores of first responders and civilians were buried in the debris and trapped in nearby buildings where they had sought refuge from the collapse.
James Longo, Inspector, NYPD. It was like that hush afterwards. I don't know what the explanation for it was, but there's that hush that comes over the city with a major snowfall.
David Norman, when you walk outside in a snowstorm, and it's such calm and peace. That's what was moments later.
Sharon Miller. It was very quiet. Almost like cotton was all over the place. Like marshmallows or something.
Richard Eichen. The street. It was like being on a beach. Your feet would sink into it, and every time you took a step, there was like more puffs of smoke. People, we were all the same color.
David Norman, we were literally caked. We were all gray. Although we had navy blue uniforms on, we were all white ash gray with debris.
Al Kim, we were like zombies for a few minutes or hours. I couldn't tell you.
Detective David Brink, Emergency Service Unit Truck 3 NYPD. There were some vehicles that were on fire and the tires were exploding from the fire. I was like, where the hell's the fire department? Why aren't they putting these fires out? Then I looked over. I saw one of the fire trucks on fire. and it sent me back to reality. Oh yeah, now I know why.
Bill Spade. This room seemed to be filled up right to the top with debris. We couldn't get out. I looked around. One of the firemen asked, "What are we going to do now?" One was a lieutenant there, and he said, "We breathe the air off the floor. We clear away the stuff, and we stay low and try to breathe the oxygen low." I said, "I ain't staying in here." One of the guys said, "We can call for help." I said, "Nobody's coming here and getting us."
Gary Smiley. I started crawling my way out of there, digging through the rocks and the debris. Just as I got out, a fireman who had also been lodged in the debris had gotten himself out. Both of us staggered around. I don't know how long we walked for.
Bill Spade. I tried banging the walls to make a hole in the wall, but we weren't getting anywhere with that. We were very tired and spent and beat up. We were in this room, I figured, around an hour. One of the younger firemen said, "I think I found a way out." At the end of the office building, top window left, there seems to be an opening. We walked along the wall. We had to feel our way around. It was a little dark, making our way over stuff. And sure enough, there was a spot up there with a little light. We made our way up on top of the debris to get up in there and made it wider. We went to the edge of where we were, up about 35 feet in the air. I remember looking out. Everything was on fire.
Gary Smiley. People started calling out, "Is anybody out there?" We went toward their voices. It was a deli owner and his wife. They pulled us into their deli. About 6 or 7 cops and some firemen were already in there, all variously injured and having a hard time breathing. They had taken a hose out of the kitchen to clean everybody off.
Jeff Johnson. I finally got out. I could see a couple of flashing lights, what we call Mars lights, the revolving lights on top of a fire truck or a police truck. I saw the yellow bumblebee stripes of a couple of coats because they reflect instantly off any light. There was no street anymore.
Alan Reese. It's quiet, except for one thing. The pass alarm.
Detective David Brink. The pass alarm. It's a really shrill sound, and that means that a firefighter is down and in trouble and he's motionless. All you heard were these pass alarms going off over and over again. You couldn't tell where they were coming from.
Al Kim. It was everywhere. That's all you heard. Beep, 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 beep sounds everywhere.
Alan Reese. All you heard was a lot of them going off.
Jeff Johnson. I made my way toward a fire truck. It so happened that there was a chief there and a fireman from rescue, Paul Hashhagen, who I happen to know. Paul was saying, "Are you okay?" I said, "Yeah, you all right? What's going on?" He said, "The tower's collapsed." I turned around and I looked and I saw the towers were actually gone. I couldn't believe it. I immediately went to the chief and I started trying to get his attention. It was frustrating to me because he wasn't listening to what I was saying. I was looking at him, man to man, looking right into his eyes and saying, "Chief, I'm missing Reuben. I'm missing this guy. We don't know where that guy is. We're up on the 22nd floor. I'm giving him all the information I can think of popping out of my head. My friend Paul said, "Jeff." I said, "What?" He said, "Jeff, turn around." I turned around and I realized there was no 22. The Marriott was gone. The chief said to us, "Head for the water."
All available boats at the waterfront. For those at the tip of Lower Manhattan, the only viable evacuation route turned out to be the water. A makeshift, unorganized armada of more than 130 ferries, pleasure yachts, sightseeing vessels, Coast Guard and police vessels, fireboats and tugboats gathered, many without being asked, at Battery Park and nearby piers. By the end of the day, they had collectively evacuated somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 people from Manhattan, a maritime rescue larger than the World War II evacuation from Dunkirk.
Lieutenant Joseph Torillo, Director of Fire Education Safety, FDNY. Two of the ambulance crews, they were digging and digging, and they found me. They got me out from underneath the rubble. They put me on this long, stiff piece of plastic called a spine board and strapped my hands to my chest. They taped my neck onto the spine board. They thought I had a broken neck. And they ran with me to the marina in the back of the World Financial Center, and they put me on the deck of a boat. With that, there was a loud rumble and a roar, and the people on the boat started screaming, "Oh my God, here comes the other building!" Everybody jumped off the boat. I was left all alone and was getting hit with the glass from the North Tower. Frantic, I bent my finger and the release belt opened and my hands were free, and I ripped the tape off of my neck. I rolled off the stretcher and I jumped into the doorway, not knowing I ended up diving headfirst into the engine room of the boat. The North Tower was hitting the deck of the boat. The boat was rocking. I thought it was going to go under.
Peter Moog, Officer NYPD. I heard a lady yell, "Help, Taru!" She had read the shirt I had on, which said TARU, Technical Assistance Response Unit, on the back. She was a lieutenant I knew, Terry Tobin, and she had a huge piece of concrete embedded in her head and two very large, jagged pieces of glass in her back, both left and right of her spine. She was lying on the ground.
Lieutenant Terry Tobin. He was a real cutie. He said, "I think I should carry you down to the water." I responded, "Peter, that's okay. I saw EMS. They wrapped my head." He said, "No, through your blouse, between your shoulder blades. There's a shard of glass sticking out of your back."
Peter Moog. I carried her down to the water. Another officer and I got her down on a boat by the North Cove Marina.
Lieutenant Terry Tobin. An NYPD harbor boat pulled up, and the captain, who I knew, hopped out and saw me. He said, "You need to go to a hospital." But I couldn't get on board with a shard of glass in my back because they were afraid that if the boat rocked, it would cause more damage. He called over two EMS workers, and as I held on to a railing, they put their feet up against the railing and ripped this glass out of my back.
Peter Moog. There were one or two fire boats and some civilian boats that people were being loaded onto. One of our harbor boats pulled in, and I knew a guy on it, Keith Duvall. He said, "Grab a sledgehammer, we'll break into one of these yachts and take it." There were about 1,000 people there all waiting to get the hell off the island. Keith and I broke into a boat. I said, "Rich people always leave the keys in the boat." We ended up finding the keys, and Keith got the boat started. I think he made about 10 trips back and forth to Jersey, taking about 100 people a trip.
Jeff Johnson. I was heading toward the water, and I ended up coming out at the south end of the marina. There was a hose from the marina, and that was the first time I was able to flush my eyes. I ran into somebody else I knew, Detective Keith Duvall, who was on a boat. He was shuttling people back and forth to Jersey. All we basically said was, "Keith, are you okay?" "Yeah, Jeff, you all right?" "Okay. Just friends, just checking."
Lieutenant Joseph Tarillo. Maybe about a half hour later, as I was losing consciousness, I heard banging on the deck of the boat, and I heard voices. And I heard somebody say, "Start the engines, start the engines." Somebody came down that long, steep flight of stairs to start the engines, and in the darkness, he stepped on my chest. I let out this loud scream. I scared the daylights out of him.
James Luongo. We were down by the Hudson, and New York waterways had pulled up, and there was a line of people to evacuate. It was surreal because the people on the boat were saying, "Women and children, women and children, women and children."
Rick Thornton, Ferry Captain Henry Hudson, New York Waterways. It was like being the last lifeboat on the Titanic.
Tom Sullivan, Firefighter, Marine 1, FDNY. Mothers and nannies with infants in their arms were dropping their children down to us. At one point, we had 4 or 5 of them wrapped in little blankets, and we put them in bunks down in the crew quarters. I put 4 babies in one bunk. Like little peanuts lined up in a row.
Lieutenant Michael Day. There was a small boat that was at the lower tip of Manhattan. I thought the boat was going to flip over because so many people were trying to get on.
Jack Ackerman, Sandy Hook Harbor pilot. At any given time, Battery Park was ringed by 10 or 12 boats waiting for people.
Herb Jones, engineer, Mary Galletly. We went back and forth all day long, carrying as many as our boat would hold. It was a lot of people. A lot of people.
Jackie Gibbs, Vice President, J.P. Morgan Chase. When we arrived at the pier, thousands of people were waiting in line. Thousands. Yet you could hear a pin drop. That was the scariest part of it. We walked blocks and blocks trying to find the end of the line. The wait lasted 3 hours.
Rick Schoenlank. They started hanging sheets over the bows of these tugs that said New Jersey or Brooklyn. People were getting on. They were in bad shape, these people, and they needed to get off the island.
Lieutenant Michael Day. We decided to make the call on the radio. All available boats, this is the United States Coast Guard aboard the pilot boat New York. Anyone available to help with the evacuation of Lower Manhattan, report to Governor's Island. About 15, 20 minutes later, there were boats all across the horizon.
Rick Schoenlank. All these commercial boats, tugs, ferries, fishing boats, launches, dinner boats. Everybody converging on the lower part of Manhattan to conduct the evacuation.
Captain James Parisi, Staten Island Ferry. Tugboats. Never seen so many tugboats all at once.
Keturah Bostic. My classmates, Shantae, Luis, and I met up in a men's bathroom at the ferry. We stayed there until we saw Mr. Sparnroft and some other students going on the Staten Island ferry. Heather Ordover. All I wanted to do was get off that island. I joked with a teacher I had never wanted to go to Staten Island so badly. Keturah Bostic. From a payphone close by, I called my mother, crying, saying, "Mommy, I'm all right. Don't worry about me. Some students are going to Staten Island. I'll call when I get there." Heather Ordover. I looked at the water and saw another ferry boat. In my book, Jersey was currently a hell of a lot safer than crossing any bridge to Brooklyn. We rounded up whoever wanted to go with us and muscled over to the boat. All we had to do was yell, "We've got students!" And the adults parted like the Red Sea.
Tim Sito, student, HSLPS. There were thousands and thousands of people on this little ferry. Everyone was standing, trying to make room for as many people as possible.
Keturah Bostic. As we rolled by the Statue of Liberty, I wondered if the statue was going to blow up. Was all of Manhattan going up in flames? And if so, was my family okay? Heather Ordover. We were underway, wearing life vests that the ferryman kept saying we didn't need. That may have been the funniest thing I heard all day. Try telling someone who is fleeing a crumbling building that they don't need a life vest. What, like we're having a good luck day?
Bert Shostak, equity broker, 100 Wall Street. A blue New York Waterway ferry boat was there, about half full, and we got on, not caring where it would take us. There were three passengers aboard of Arab descent who had backpacks, and people, average people, not police officers, demanded to know what was in them. The guys looked scared and opened their backpacks. Inside, just books.
Captain James Parisi. There was dust all over the boat. People were crying, people were covered with dust, and some people had no shoes. We had at least 6,000 people on the boat.
Lieutenant Michael Day. We had hundreds of people waiting to get over here, and we had a captain. He said, "I don't have a crew." The ferry had 350 people on it. He said, "I need some help." There were some New Jersey state troopers, and I said, "Hey, would you mind helping this guy?" They said, "No problem, whatever we can do." I was like, I hope nothing happens to this ferry. I broke more rules that day than probably I've enforced in my whole Coast Guard career.
Paul Amico, dock builder, Amico Ironworks. If we had injured people on board, mostly firemen, we immediately released the ladder and sent that boat back to Jersey.
Lieutenant Joseph Tarillo. The boat skipped across the Hudson River, and I could hear a lot of commotion, people yelling on the deck to people on the shore of Jersey City. There were ambulances waiting there.
Joseph Lott, scheduled to attend the Risk Waters conference, had escaped the building after going to change his shirt to wear his new tie. He evacuated south toward Battery Park, where he ended up on one of the escaping boats.
Joseph Lott, sales representative, Compact Computers. We sat on the ferry for maybe 4 or 5 minutes, and then all of a sudden, the ferry took off. Within 2 minutes, we were in bright sunshine. Beautiful day. Statue of Liberty was in front of us. The water was lapping against the ferry. I looked around. The ferry was completely packed. There were some injured people. Most of us were covered in soot and ash and dust. We were all sitting there, and all I could think about was how much burnt asbestos was in my mouth at that point. It was very gritty. I said, I've got to have something to drink. I went up to the little snack bar on the ferry, and there was nobody there. Inside were all these beers sitting on ice. I grabbed a handful of beers, and I walked back to my colleagues, and I said, look what I found. Does anybody have an opener? And so somebody produced an opener and said, I'll open if you give me one of those. We all sat down, and we drank this beer, and I can't remember a beer that ever tasted that good.
Frank Rosano. As we were going across the river, I was looking back at the city expecting to see the World Trade Center, expecting to see a tower with the top off. They weren't there. I said to the guy driving the boat, well, where's the World Trade Center? He said, buddy, they're gone. I said, look, I was there when the tops of the buildings came down, but where's the rest of the building? He said, buddy, it wasn't the tops of the buildings. They collapsed down to the foundations.
Michelle Goldman, labor attorney, 1 Battery Park Plaza. As we got off the boat in Jersey City, rescue workers formed a pathway for us. They helped people who had trouble walking. They gave us bottled water, food, and towels. It almost felt like reaching a finish line.
Across New York City, everyone seemed dazed in the wake of the collapses. Officials struggled to discover who had survived. Those who had been injured sought treatment amid the chaos.
Dan Nigro, as you got back to the scene and saw what was left of it, it looked like war.
Monsignor John Delendick. Dan Nigro came walking down Chambers Street. He said, who's in charge? Do we know who's in charge? I said, Chief, I don't know. I think you are.
Dan Nigro. I was told the command center was now at Barclay and Broadway at the tip of City Hall Park, and Deputy Chief Tom Herring from Division 6 was in charge. I felt that if that was the case, that meant everyone else had been killed. Every other ranking member of the department.
Monsignor John Delendick. A lot of stuff at that moment was a blur. People started combing through the stuff, trying to find people.
Dan Nigro. I wanted to get back to the fire command post and see if the people I left at West Street survived. On the way there, I ran into someone I knew, and he said, Dan, Pete's gone. Pete's gone.
Sharon Miller. My husband had started driving home to New York from Florida. His daughter somehow got through to him and said, Dad, I saw Sharon. She's out of the building. She's all right. She's with 2 other officers. While we were running up West Street, she had seen me on TV. He didn't really believe her. Then another of his friends called him. Ray, Sharon's fine. I saw her on TV. Ray, I have a 50-inch TV. I saw her. He was at a rest area. He sat down and he lit a cigar. Then he drove the rest of the way home.
Al Kim. I started to see clean shirts. That was a big deal. The cavalry had arrived, if you will. I remember seeing people I knew with no dust, no burns. They were normal. It was a welcoming sight.
Richard Grasso, Chairman and CEO, New York Stock Exchange. My colleague Howard turned to me with the phone in his hand and said, it's the mayor. I took the phone and he said to me, how you doing? I was numb. My only thought was to repeat his question, and I said, how you doing? It sounded like the Budweiser commercial. No, how you doing? I finally said, how am I doing? You're supposed to be dead. He said, I'm not dead. I'm fine.
Detective David Brink. We were walking up and we saw a church, St. Paul's. One of the doors was open, so we all piled up inside, the five of us. I hid in the front by the altar and started praying. I fell to my knees and said, "Thank you, God, for letting me survive this." And I said, "Please give me the strength to go on and help other people that are there." I said, "I know we lost a lot of guys in there. God, please watch over them." My eyes were crusted through with pieces of glass and dust and debris. I couldn't see. I found the holy water there. I was looking for any water, so I scooped my hands into the holy water. I was washing off my eyes, and my face was wet. I needed something to wipe my face off with. My uniform was covered from head to toe in the dust. I went in by where the altar is, and they had the vestments and the other little cloths that were used for the rituals and ceremonies of the Catholic Church. I found a little one. It was a little white cloth that they would put over the chalice when they were doing the wine ceremony, and it had a little red cross stitched into it. I dipped that in the holy water and started wiping my eyes off. I looked up, and the priest had come out. I said, "Ah, boy, I'm in trouble now." He says, "No, my son, that's what they're supposed to be used for. It's okay." I said, "Thank you, Father." And I dipped it again in the holy water. Then I put it around my neck and tied it there because the cool water felt good on the back of my neck.
Richard Eichen. I managed in a meandering way to get into Beekman Downtown Hospital. They had a ramp and stairs, and I said, "I'm taking the ramp. I had it with stairs for today, thank you." They put me in an elevator downstairs to what must have been a cafeteria they set up as a triage center. A woman in scrubs came over and set me up. She opened up some water and poured it over me, over my front, trying to figure out how badly I was hurt. They led me to a seat in front of a doctor, a young woman, and she did maybe three or four big X stitches on my forehead to close it up. I heard what happened for the first time in the nurse's station. They were playing the television. I was still not really comprehending it. I remember thinking, "Holy crap, I don't know who did this, but they knocked down our building. We're all in the street. This is a time to do something anti-personnel, biological. What do I know about this stuff?" I put my shoes back on, no socks, put my pants back on. They were gray at this point. My shirt was in a bag. It was a hospital bag. And I was wearing the gown, and I walked out.
Can you get air support? Mid-morning at the Pentagon. By late morning, officials realized few survivors would still be found inside the Pentagon. They labored to grasp the extent of the damage to the massive building, contain the still-spreading fires, and gather evidence of the attack. Meanwhile, evacuated Pentagon workers spread out across Arlington, beginning an anguished journey home as the initial shock of the attacks wore off. The morning's collective nervous anxiety that more attacks might be afoot wouldn't lift until the military arrived at the scene overhead.
Chris Combs, Special Agent FBI at the Pentagon. I grabbed a DPS guy, their SWAT team was there, and said I wanted the SWAT team. We had learned from studying with the Israelis that oftentimes after an attack, the terrorists knew there would be a command post, and they would run a suicide bomber into the middle of it.
Stephen Hall, Deputy Chief, Arlington County Police Department. We put up a couple of our counter-snipers on the Drug Enforcement Administration building on the other side of Interstate 395. That way they could overlook the entire south parking lot, where a lot of the relief efforts were set up.
Chris Combs. The other thing I requested right away was for the FBI to send our surveillance teams. If there was a truck bomb sitting somewhere else in Arlington, or if there were four guys in a minivan with automatic weapons, we needed to find that before they hit us. We took our surveillance teams and had them drive around the Pentagon on the outskirts, looking for any other type of attack. Scott Coker, Contractor, SAIC, Pentagon. This woman pulled up her car, turned on the radio. The announcer mentioned one of the trade centers had collapsed. Nobody could make much sense of that because it seemed impossible.